Don't feel too sorry for me, but this weather is not normal for me. We're very wimpy. Actually, we get hot weather in California, but we always have air conditioning, so. Oh. All right. So, tomorrow we're going to have a class on Hebrews. We're going to have a little bit more apologetics about Jesus. As we're pointing out with Oni, there's really two areas of apologetics. One is defending the reliability of the Bible. The other one is defending the inspiration of the Bible. So the reason today's apologetics, for some of you, was a little bit boring, let's be honest. So a few of you, you were slightly bored. Not a lot bored, but a little bored. It's because we're defending the reliability, but I think defending the inspiration of the Bible is honestly more inspiring, right? All right? So, and this one tonight is kind of in between, actually. It's a little bit of both. So I'm going to talk about God and science. Now, I do have a fair amount of background in this area. You know, I do have a PhD in chemical physics, and I was a chemistry and physics professor for about 35 years. I gave this talk at Harvard University a few years ago, and one of the students, he wasn't from Harvard, he was from MIT. And we had a question and answer session, and he came up, he's like 18 or 19, he says, "Oh, Mr. Oaks," not Dr. Oaks, "Mr. Oaks, you have no right to talk on this topic. You don't know. Yeah, where's your, your qualifications?" "Oh, excuse me, you freshman in college." I didn't say that. I mean, I do have a PhD in chemistry and physics. I think I'm somewhat qualified to talk on this. A little bit. Anyway, he went on and he actually started a website. You know, "Watch out for Dr. Oaks," and he wrote to the president of my college and all my colleagues at work and, you know, people across our church and everything, whatever. It's like, okay, nothing better to do. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit about my background. So I grew up going to church. It was an Episcopalian church. It's kind of like Anglican. And there's the Anglicanism here in Africa. It's pretty solid, but that kind of in America, very, very liberal. In fact, I think the African Anglicans just disowned the Archbishop of Canterbury because he says, you know, gays can be priests and stuff like that. So it wasn't like a strong, convicting Christianity, but, you know, I went up going to church and I wore the robe and I carried the cross and, you know, I was the president of the church youth group, but I was also a marijuana smoking, you know, profanity using, you know, and I didn't believe in God at all. I was an atheist. And in that church, it was okay to be an atheist and be the youth group president. But anyway, so when I went off to college, I was so proud of being an atheist. I remember the Christian guys came and they were inviting us to something. We laughed at them. All right. But then actually in my junior year in the university, I was studying physics and chemistry and I realized, whoa, wait a minute. There's a God. All right. And so I started searching. I became a Christian. Now, there's two views of reality, I guess you could say. I could do our talk on worldview, but I'm not going to be able to. And so there's the atheist view of nature, all right? And that would be represented by Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley was a good friend of Charles Darwin. Darwin was not an atheist, but Huxley was. And Huxley said this. He said, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to the earth or the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." We're just a complete accident. Just random events. Here we are. That's the atheist perspective. Another statement, this is 19th century, would be Richard Dawkins, a 20th 21st century evolutionist who wrote The God Delusion. And he says something quite similar, actually. He says, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. The DNA neither knows nor cares, it just is, and we dance to its music. Now, if that were true, at the very least, it's very depressing. But my question is whether that's true. He says, there's no evidence of design or purpose. It's just all random stuff. Just accidents and, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, that's the atheist perspective. My question is, does that make sense given what we know? Now, the opposite position would be the position that says, actually, no, there is evidence in nature for design. One of the earliest proponents of this was William Paley, who made the watchmaker argument. But I'm not going to use the watchmaker argument. I'm going to use the cell phone argument. We don't have pocket watches. We don't have pocket watches. We have cell phones, all right? So William Paley said, let's imagine you're walking down the street and you see a cell phone line there. You're saying to yourself, well, how did that happen? Was it blind, pitiless indifference and just random events? Or was it design? So let's go for the atheist argument. You know, there was some plastic, some silicon, some glass, some metal, you know, and then a car ran over it, and then people kicked it around, and pock, and then, sorry, cell phone. Thank you for laughing. That's insane. That's ridiculous. Anybody believes this was not designed needs to go to a mental hospital, okay? Now, my question is this. Which has more design? A cell phone or the simplest bacteria? I say the simplest bacteria has more evidence for design. Thank you very much. The simplest bacteria is a nano factory of incredible, unbelievable complexity. And the atheist believes it just happened. And so my question is that a reasonable proposition, or is the idea of God and a creator a more reasonable explanation of reality? I think the cell phone is maybe, well, it's a pretty good example. I think of this. Let's think about you've got a junkyard full of all kinds of, you know, metal, dirt, glass, junk, you know. A huge storm comes through there, throws everything in the air, and out comes the 747. What do you think? That doesn't make sense. So what I'm going to do is I've taught introductory chemistry. I've taught introductory organic chemistry and biochemistry and physics. So I'm going to go through things that I would teach in just a standard, normal introductory science class. And I'm going to use this to show beyond any reasonable doubt of anybody even remotely reasonable that the first idea is wrong and the second idea makes sense. So basically then I'm going to try to prove to you that a creator God exists. Now, proof is a funny word here. It's not proof as in I can prove that 2 + 2 = 4. It's prove as in the only reasonable conclusion. Okay, got it? So let's talk about chemistry first. I'm a chemist. Now I teach introductory chemistry, and I'm telling you, you could teach an entire one semester course to explain all the properties that water has that no other compound has. Wow. And the fact is, every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life anywhere on the earth. So we could argue for design or accident. And I would say design is the only reasonable conclusion. Let me give you a few examples. First of all, one thing about water is water is bent. It's bent at a 109-degree angle. Now, that's really important. logically, if I connected three things together, it'd be a straight line, right? It's the most obvious shape of the three, but it's bent. Why is that important? Well, it turns out if water was a straight line, then it would boil around minus 200 degrees centigrade. Now, that would be a problem because scientists tell us, and even common sense tells us, life requires a liquid to dissolve the substances in that living thing. And scientists would tell you that liquid has to be liquid somewhere between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Below that range, there's not enough energy to initiate chemical reactions. Above that temperature, all sensitive molecules simply fall apart. Now, water happens to be liquid across almost that entire range, but I'm going to show you a reason why it's important that it's not a liquid across the entire range. Now, this solvent, this liquid, has to be a solvent, and it has to dissolve a very wide range of kinds of molecules. It just so happens that of all the liquids that are liquid in the right temperature range, water dissolves a wider range of molecules than any other. Now, it turns out also, in order for a living thing to exist, it has to dissolve ions. We call them minerals, like sodium and potassium and nitrate and these things. Guess how many liquids at net temperature range dissolve ions? Only one. So the same molecule that has the right boiling point is also the only molecule that dissolves ions. Now, water dissolves a very wide range of molecules, but luckily it doesn't dissolve everything, because if it did, we'd all be a puddle, and that would be a problem. You're supposed to laugh now. When I tell jokes, please laugh. No? Okay. I won't bother to tell any more jokes, because you don't get my jokes. All right. Next, another thing about water is it has a very high specific heat. I know that's a very technical term, but let me explain it. What it means is water absorbs a lot of heat. In fact, water absorbs 10 times more heat than almost all other substances. In fact, it absorbs at least twice as much heat as all substances. Now, it just so happens, the one molecule that is liquid in the right temperature range, and that's the same one that dissolves this widest range of molecules, it also just so happens to have the highest specific heat. Why is that important? Well, if water did not have such a high specific heat, then in between the winter and the summer, the temperature of the earth would go up and down by about 200 degrees centigrade, and all life would be destroyed. All right, that's not the only property. Water has this very interesting property, which is that the solid floats on top of the liquid. You go, I knew that. Yeah, ice floats. Well, did you know that that is not a normal property? There are millions and millions of compounds. Every single compound, the solid sinks and the liquid floats. Guess how many exceptions there are? One. And that's water. Well, why is that important? Because it gets cold in the winter and the water freezes. By the way, that's also very important. I'm about to explain that. Because what happens is the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. And ice is a very poor conductor of heat. And it protects the lakes from freezing to the bottom. Now, I realize that that probably does not convince you here in Liberia. By the way, I used to live in Wisconsin. And can I tell you something you didn't know? In Wisconsin, the people walk on water. In the winter. Please laugh at my joke. I can't tell that joke in America because they don't, you know, like, no kidding. But anyway. Now there's another, by the way, in the winter, during ice ages, the oceans would have frozen to the bottom. Okay, now water is this another weird property. All right. Every molecule in the universe, if you plot density versus temperature, it goes like this. Guess how many exceptions there are? Exactly one, and that's water. Water, when you prop the density, it goes like this, and then it drops. At 4 degrees, it goes like that. So below 4 degrees, instead of water getting more dense, it gets more light. So what that means is, in the winter, the cold ice floats on top of the cold water, which floats on top of the warm water. Everybody knows warm heat rises and warm water rises. Not below 4 degrees centigrade. Now, if you didn't get that, it's okay. Hopefully you're getting the point, which is water has a very long list of properties, most of which I'm not even taking the time to describe. Every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And you know, one molecule has to have all those properties. Some people say, well, it just got lucky. It's just a lucky accident and we're here. Okay. If you want to believe that one, you can go with that. Okay, that's fine. All right, next, I'm going to show you. This is, get ready, this is going to be scary. Okay, there you go. Oh, some of you are getting nervous, probably having breakout and hives, you know, like that. All right, periodic chart. Everybody knows what the periodic chart is, right? All right? All right. Now, I tell my students that the Russian scientist Mendeleev invented that chart. 5 years ago, I was in Kiev, and I lectured in the same hall where Mendeleev lectured. That was sort of cool. Anyway, I say that Mendeleev invented that chart, and historically that's true, but I say no. God invented that chart. God's fingerprints are all over that chart. There are at least 22 elements that I can list that have a property that no other element has, and if that element didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. Coincidence or design? I think it becomes fairly obvious. And I say to the atheist, you know, why are there so many elements? The Greeks said there are only 4 elements, but there's really more like 100 elements. Why are there so many elements? Why? Because there are, I don't know, why? Well, the reason there's so many elements is because we need a lot of properties. My first example will be carbon, all right? Carbon, I teach organic chemistry, and when I teach organic chemistry, I do the first two lectures, the entire first two lectures, explaining all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. And again, every one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. And it needs to be the same element that has all of those properties. Okay, a few examples. Now, again, if you don't understand exactly what I'm talking about, it doesn't matter. Please get the picture, all right? So for some of you, you're getting all the technical details. For others, you don't totally get the technical details. But hopefully you get the picture, okay? So here we go. There's carbon. The thing about carbon is it forms 4 bonds. Now, by the way, carbon is not the only element that forms 4 bonds. There's one other element that forms 4 bonds. And those of you know chemistry, the similarities in the column, not in the row, right? Chemistry people, all right, okay. So the other element that forms 4 bonds is silicon. The problem with silicon is, if you join 2 silicon atoms together, that molecule explodes. Not very appropriate for a life-giving molecule. But anyway, why 4 bonds? Well, it turns out, molecules that form 1 bond are linear. Molecules with 2 bonds are also linear, usually, except water. And then molecules with 3 bonds are planar, they're flat. You need to have 4 bonds before the molecule is 3-dimensional. You're saying, okay, that's so boring, why is that important? Well, if molecules weren't 3-dimensional, then molecules wouldn't be 3-dimensional if atoms were not. And if molecules weren't 3-dimensional, neither would living things be 3-dimensional. So again, carbon has that unique property. That's not the only property that carbon has. Another property that carbon has is it's the only element that forms large molecules. It's the only one. So, the only element which has 4 bonds, which allows molecules to be 3-dimensional, is also the only element that forms large molecules. And if you didn't have large molecules, you wouldn't have DNA or proteins or anything else required for life. And by the way, the list, there's quite a much longer list of unique properties of carbon, like its ring structure and a bunch of other stuff that I won't bore you with. Just trust me, the list goes beyond that. Trust me. Okay, good. Another element is, let me see, let's go back to my periodic chart. Iron, right there, iron. Iron, F-E. Iron has a property that no element has. Iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. No other element does. Okay? Why is that important? Well, that's why you can, you know, put the homework on the refrigerator for your children. Another joke. Nobody's laughing, but okay. Never mind. All right, here's why. Turns out the sun, and by the way, I could talk about the design of the sun. It's an awesome thing, and helium. And luckily for hydrogen, luckily for the properties of hydrogen, otherwise we'd have no stars. But anyway, the sun, 80% of the energy it gives off is visible light. Lucky for us, because that's the only form of energy which can cause chemical reactions without destroying the molecules. Thank you, God, that almost all the energy from the sun is visible light. All right, but there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, both of which would utterly destroy all life on the earth if it weren't for two different elements. One of those is called the solar wind. It's high energy protons and electrons. All right? But it turns out the magnetic field of the earth, which is produced from the iron, is literally a force field. It bends it around. Have you heard about the northern lights, the aurora borealis? That's the small amount that leaks near the north and south pole. Thank God for iron. Now, humans would like to go to Mars, right? Well, one of the problems they're going to have to solve is they're going to have to make a shielding for those particles. All right, now, it turns out iron has another interesting property. Iron has the most stable nucleus of all the elements. The most stable nucleus. Why is that important? Well, what's the Earth made out of mostly? Iron! It's mainly made of iron. And if it wasn't mainly made out of iron, there wouldn't be a magnetic field, you see. So the same element that's the only magnetic element is also the same element that's the most common element in the earth. Lucky for us. So let's say, I don't know, let's say vanadium was magnetic. And we would all be, there would be no life. So that's quite a coincidence, I'd say. No, that's no coincidence. Okay, next, let me see. Next is oxygen. The other kind of energy that comes from the sun, which would destroy all life, is the hard ultraviolet. The soft ultraviolet creates, like, sunburn. I don't know, you guys maybe not struggle as much as I do with that, but even too, I hear black people can get sunburned. That's what they tell me. Amen. All right. Anyway, so it turns out oxygen is such an interesting element because there are two forms of oxygen. There's O2, and that sustains high metabolism life. Oxygen is the only element that can sustain high metabolism life forms. All right? But the other form of oxygen is ozone, O3, which is highly poisonous. But amazingly, almost all the ozone on the earth is in the upper atmosphere. Is in the upper atmosphere, not down here. And it absorbs the ultraviolet radiation. Lucky for us. Otherwise, there'd be no life. All right, that's why we have to protect the ozone, by the way. Humans should not be destroying it. Okay. Next is uranium. By the way, like I said, there are 22 elements. This will be my last example. Uranium has a property that no element has, and that is it's radioactive, and it has a very, very long half-life. Now, you probably think of uranium as a dangerous substance because it's radioactive, yes? Well, it turns out uranium is not as dangerous as you think. The reason is it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. So you could actually have a chunk of uranium in your house. It's the other compounds, the radium and all the other things, all those that are the dangerous ones. But anyway, don't live in a uranium mine. That's very bad. But anyway, here's the point. Lucky for us, because uranium is a very, very dense element, very, very dense. So guess where almost all the uranium is? In the center of the earth producing heat. And the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old, which means around half the uranium is still around. Lucky for us. Otherwise, the Earth would be cold and solid all the way to the middle. Then we'd have no plate tectonics. You say, so who cares? Well, plate tectonics, it does two things. First of all, it's like a massive recycling system, and it recycles the surface of the Earth. Otherwise, the Earth's surface would be sterile. It recycles the minerals. Otherwise, the Earth's surface would be sterile, and we would have no, you know, maybe very, very simple life, and that would be about it. The other thing that plate tectonics does, it gives us an atmosphere. Without plate tectonics, we wouldn't have an atmosphere. Now you say, well, I don't like planets with uranium. Great, go to Mars. There's almost no uranium in the planet Mars. And there's also, like, basically no atmosphere, and it's also very sterile. Good luck growing a farm on Mars. All right, so thank you, God, for the properties of uranium. That's a little chemistry. Now let me go on to biochemistry. I love teaching biochemistry because there's probably more examples in biochemistry that shows God than any other area of science, in my opinion. I'm only going to use one example, and that's DNA. I assume everybody here has heard about DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. That's the stuff that contains the information that makes us. Now, we have around 3 billion of these nucleotides. Here's what the molecule looks like. Here's the G, C, A, and T. Guanine, cytosine, thymine, adenine. These are those nucleotides. And the way it works is any set of 3 nucleotides, like CGT or TTA or whatever, 3 nucleotides makes a code which chooses the amino acid to make a protein. Now, remember our friend Huxley said, you know, single series of very beneficial actions. Let me ask you a question, Thomas Huxley. So do you believe that random collisions of molecules could create a code? Just molecules bumping into each other, suddenly there's this code. That's nonsense. That makes no sense. All right? So where did the code come from? Obviously from an intelligent designer. That's quite obvious. And oh my goodness, I could go on and on about DNA and the narrow groove and the wide groove. There's so many features of this molecule that is like blow away amazing. How well it preserves the information. But here's the thing. It has that information. And one thing about the universe is the universe never spontaneously creates information. That there's a law of thermodynamics about that. It does not do that. But I'm talking about a lot of information. In the case of human beings, that's like 3 billion letters. You change one letter out of 4 billion and that person dies. Okay? Well, that's not the best model for the simplest life. The best model would be maybe like a bacteria, E. coli or something like that. 100 million letters. Let's cut it in half. 50 million letters. Let's cut it in half. 25 million letters. So that's 25 million letters of information required to have a living thing. The probability of that happening by random, it'd be like this. Take a bag full of 25 million letters, the number in like 10 novels, throw them in the air, and when they fall to the ground, you could read it in French. Just random accident. Atheists actually believe that. Oh, come on. Give me a break. They say, well, the secret formula is time. Time does not solve this problem. Trust me. Right, but then there's another thing on top of that, which is this. It turns out the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. You know about which came first, the chicken or the egg? I say to the atheist, which came first, the protein or the DNA? And the only answer to the atheist is they both came at the same time, by coincidence. In other words, what they propose is the protein that would have made the DNA And the DNA that would have made this same protein had to both simultaneously be created at the same time and in the same place. It's like saying, which came first, the chicken or the egg? They both came at the same time. That's a ridiculous answer. But the atheist believes this. Why do they believe this? Ask them, don't ask me. All right, that's biochemistry. Let me see. Oh, yeah. A point here, a bit of a fine point. Nature creates order, but not information. Nature spontaneously creates order, such as that kind of order. But it does not ever create information. Creating information would be like creating a house of cards spontaneously. Imagine you throw a bunch of cards in the air, and they form a house of cards. Right, thank you for laughing. That's the first time anybody laughed at anything I said tonight, was when I said that, because that is a joke. But atheists believe that sort of thing. All right, okay, one more is physics. All right, a little chemistry, a little biochemistry. Now some physics. Okay, now, up until the 1940s, physicists were unanimous in this belief, which is that the universe was eternal. Okay? The universe had always existed. Why? Because of evidence from experiment? No, actually not. They believed it for philosophical reasons. Because really, there's only two possibilities. Either the universe is eternal, or it was created. But if it was created, that creates a philosophical, not a scientific, but a philosophical problem for the atheists. Because if it was created, that means there's a creator. So atheists came up with this eternal universe idea, not because of experiment, but because it was required to maintain their atheism. But the Bible, of course, all along had said very differently. For example, in Hebrews 11:3, it says, by faith we understand that the universe was created so that what is seen has not been made from things that are visible. In other words, something that was invisible created everything that is visible. Thank you very much. And then in the 1930s, I'm going to give you a little bit of scientific detail. Don't worry yourself too much about it. They discovered this thing called the red shift, which basically showed that distant objects are moving away from us. Basically what it proved is the universe is expanding at an incredibly fast rate. Well, if it's expanding, that means it used to be smaller. And so it led to the idea that it used to be just a point. And that's the idea of what's called the Big Bang model. Now, it's not like atheists said, thank you very much for proving the universe was created. Oh, they resisted this very vigorously. But then in the 1960s, they made a second discovery. Again, the details, don't worry about it too much, called microwave background radiation, other things. By the 1960s, the physicists, even the atheists, were going, yeah, I guess the universe was created. They called it the Big Bang. All right. So here's what here's the unanimous view of all cosmologists. There was nothing. Not only no energy and no mass, but not even time or space. And at one instant, in a brilliant flash of light, the entire universe came to exist from nothing. All the energy, all the matter, even space itself, and even time itself. Before this event, even time didn't exist, never mind matter, energy, or space. So finally, physicists caught up with the Bible. Thank you very much. All right? Now, but then as cosmologists began to study, by the way, I can't prove that this happened. All I can say is from science, the evidence is very consistent with this conclusion, that the universe was created. Okay, good. But then as scientists investigated this creation event, they don't like to call it the creation event, so they call it the Big Bang. All right, they noticed a few interesting coincidences. They noticed that the universe is finely tuned. And now what that means is there are many factors, all of which have to be exactly precisely aligned in a very, very precise way And if they aren't all exactly at the right value, the whole thing doesn't work. It's like a car. You have, 100 different parts in the car. If you take any part out, the whole thing doesn't work. So they all have to be working. And how could they all be working simultaneously at the same time? All right, so again, if you don't quite get that, I'll give you my example. I think, oh yeah, okay, I get that. Okay, now would you agree that that's a small number? That's a very, very small number. 59 zeros and finally a one. Now that represents this. What scientists discovered is the force of gravity is really, really important to creating the universe as we see it. Because the universe is expanding, correct? It's getting less and less dense. The only reason we have stars and galaxies and planets is because gravity as a force makes the matter condense down. Here's what they discovered. If the force of gravity had been bigger than it is, by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. And if the force of gravity was smaller than it actually is, by that same fraction, planets and stars would have never formed. So I have two questions for the atheists. Why is there gravity? Because there is. That's not a very satisfying answer. And then, why does gravity, of all the possible universes that you could have, why does the force of gravity happen to have that value fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 60th? That number represents the probability that the atheist is right. I would not want to take that bet. To explain how small a number that is, I was in Ghana. They have the lottery everywhere. Do they have lottery here? They do. It's a Christian country. They have lottery betting, legal. All right. Let's imagine this. Let's imagine you had a friend and they won the big lottery. What would you say? Go, woohoo! They say, wait a minute, you're a Christian. Why are you gambling? But never mind that. That was another joke. Anyway. All right. Okay, good. Let's say the next week they win the big lottery again. And then the next week they win the big lottery a third time in a row. They would be in jail. They would be in jail. This number is equivalent to winning the big lottery 6 times in a row. What's the probability? 0. But the thing is, that's just one example. There are dozens of parameters that determine how the universe works that are like this. It's not the only one. There's like more than 30 that have been found. It involves technical details like the amount of charge in the universe and so many other things. I'll just give you one example that maybe you sort of get. There's different fundamental forces. There's a gravity force, electric force. Another force is called the strong nuclear force. Now, what that is the force that attracts protons and neutrons together. Protons, like charges repel and opposite charge. Yeah, protons repel. So why do they stay together? Because of the neutrons. Okay? Now, the strong nuclear force, if it was just a little bit bigger, there'd be no hydrogen. And if there's no hydrogen, there'd also be no stars. That'd be a problem. But if it's just a little bit smaller, there'd be only hydrogen. And that would be just as big of a problem. Goldilocks, just right. And the weak nuclear force, the electric force, the electron to proton ratio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is irrational to propose that this is just an accident. Now, I know what they did. Atheists always have an excuse. So they said, you might have heard of what's called the multiverse theory. The idea that there's an infinite number of universes and we happen to live in the right one. That is not a scientific theory. I'm telling you, by definition, that is literally not a scientific theory. Okay. Let me see. A super intellect has monkeyed with physics, chemistry, biology. I didn't even talk about biology, by the way. Anthony Flew, the most well-known and infamous atheist in the second half of the 20th century, 2004, he finally said, all right, I admit it. Obviously, there's a designer. Thank you, Anthony Flew, for catching up with reality. Other things, the right galaxy, the right kind of galaxy, the right star, the right kind of planet, blah, blah, blah. All right, Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what was been made so that people are without excuse. I agree with that. But you know who has the least excuse for not believing in God? It's the scientist. I mean, how could a scientist not believe in God? Talk about no excuse. So I say, don't be intimidated by smart-looking bald men with glasses, you know, that tell you that if you're a scientist, you have to believe in atheism. To illustrate this, I was in a van. This is a few years ago. It was like, I don't know, 8 or 10. They're all, you know, university science professors. And, of course, some of them were atheists. Not all scientists are atheists. I'm a good example. But quite a few are. But the thing is, the atheists are the loud ones. And they're so arrogant, as if everybody would agree with them. They seem to not be self-aware enough to realize that actually a lot of scientists don't agree with them. But that's not my point. So we're in this van. She says, Christianity, what a stupid religion. I just can't believe that. She said, did you know in the Old Testament it says if you wear clothing of more than one material, like, say, cotton and wool, capital punishment. What a stupid religion. I had to say something, you know. I said, excuse me, the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. Guess where she didn't see it? In the Bible. Now, I pulled my Bible out. I got a question. Could you find that passage? I had to. First, I said, you know, people say all the time that a scientist can't possibly believe in God because there's so many scientific contradictions in the Bible. I said, I've read the Bible, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. I've never found one. I don't know what they're talking about. It got really quiet in there. Then I pulled out my Bible. Then it got really quiet. And I didn't know the exact reference. I knew it was in Leviticus. I knew it was on the right-hand side of the page. I remembered that. Not halfway down. Flipped through. Ah, found it. And by the way, it does mention about wearing clothes with two materials. And the Jewish rabbis will tell you it's about purity. It's basically God saying, he said, don't plant two crops. And the Jews understand that it's about being pure and separating yourself. But it does not say anything about capital punishment. Come on. Give me a break. All right. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do part two. Part two is a little bit shorter than part one. A little bit shorter. Talk about science in the Bible. Up till now, technically, other than quoting Hebrews 11:3, I haven't argued for God from the Bible. I've argued God from science, correct? So now, okay, which God? Because remember, I told you that when I was like a junior in college, I'm like, wow, there's a God. I did not assume the Christian God. I tell you right now, I did not assume that. In fact, initially, I was more attracted to Hinduism and Buddhism and sort of Eastern pantheism. The problem with pantheism is pantheism predicts the universe is eternal, and it's not. I didn't really make that connection at the time. It was only a couple years later that I started reading the Bible. I'm like, oh, wow, wow, and I became a Christian. Now, by the way, it wasn't science that convinced me of the Bible. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you evidence from science that supports the conclusion that the Bible is inspired by God. Tomorrow I'm going to show you even much better evidence, but this isn't talking about science. I can do that. Now, here's a claim, kind of like what that woman said in that van, but Dulles McCown, he's a renowned atheist and Christian hater. He said, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. That's not true, but let's go on. He says, philosophically suspect at best, and disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. Let's stop right there. The Bible is historically fraudulent. You were here earlier today, right? The Bible is historically fraudulent. No. Can you please give me a single example? I mean, even one example. Why do people say stuff like this? Why do they say these things? Philosophically suspect at best. So you're going to put atheism as a better philosophy than Christian philosophy, theology? That's not my topic tonight. I'm going to talk about that a little bit on Thursday morning. All right, but how about scientifically unsupportable? I beg to differ. Like I said, I'm a physicist and chemist. My PhD is in both fields. And I'm trained to be skeptical. It's kind of my job to be skeptical. And I've not found this science error in the Bible yet. I haven't found it. Maybe it's there. All right, this is Papyrus Ebers. This is an Egyptian document. It was discovered. And this manuscript is not from 1500 BC, but scholars predict that this came from around 1500 BC. The date is kind of important. I'll explain why in a second. What it is, it's a collection of medical knowledge. It's kind of like the physician's desk reference, except in Egypt. All right? And the fact that it comes from around 1500 BC is important because that's kind of close to when Moses wrote what we find, for example, in Leviticus. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to compare Leviticus to Ebers. Let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers, all right? You want to prevent your hair from turning gray? Good. Anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. That might work. Here's another one. A mixture of six fats, the horse, hippopotamus, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. Now, obviously, I haven't been using that stuff. All right, we're laughing. Thank you. That's funny. All right. But you know what? Actually, I don't think it's really actually funny, even though I'm laughing too. Because think about this. The average lifespan in the ancient world was probably less than 20 years. It's not like people couldn't live longer, it's just on average, because almost everybody died from some kind of infectious disease, right? All right, now let's look at some other medicines in Papyrus Ebers. Here we go. Lizard's blood. Okay. Pig teeth. Rotten meat. This moisture from pig's ears. And how about excrement? Yes, even human excrement was used to cure disease. Got a little, you know, I don't know. Right. And again, I show you this not to shame the Egyptians, because the Egyptians were no better or worse. In fact, I believe probably some of the things they proposed might have even worked. You know, some of the, even the herbal information that, you know, native cultures here, some of that probably even actually works, you know, some of it. I don't deny that. But the thing is, let's compare it to the Bible. My good friend, John Clayton, he's not from our fellowship, he's from the Church of Christ, very good friend of mine, and he was the child of two very ardent atheists, both philosophers at Columbia University, like total atheists. And he was working for a woman named Madeline O'Hare, who is the president of the American Atheist Society. He was a total atheist. And he was writing a book. He was fairly young, in his 20s. And the title of the proposed book was The Bible, a book written by an ignorant people in an ignorant age. And in doing his research, John Clayton became a Christian. Yeah. It's like, couldn't find any of that stuff. All right. Here's a very interesting passage that I'm guessing possibly you've never noticed. Exodus 15:26. God says to his people, if you follow the laws I'm giving you today, the diseases that your neighbors have, you will not have. That's interesting. And when we look at some of those laws, we begin to see why that is. For example, certain meats. God said, beef, yes, pork, no. Fish with scales, yes. Shellfish, no. Now, it just so happens that pork carries at least 22 diseases, a number of which are fatal, including trichinosis. Now, if we have fair modern health standards, pork is relatively safe, but I still say cook it all the way through, all the way through. Beef, on the other hand, is relatively safe. In fact, even raw beef is relatively safe. They call it steak tartare. I was in Venezuela a few years ago, and I was ordering off the menu. I speak Spanish, but I didn't know what the stuff on the menu was. I said, bring me that one. And they brought me out a plate of raw beef. And I'm thinking, all right, great. Exodus, you know, Leviticus 11. Yeah, I went, go for it, okay? All right, now, I'm telling you, eating raw clams, bad idea. Eating raw crustaceans in general, very dangerous. Eating raw fish, sushi. Yes, safe. And every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. And every meat on the do eat list is relatively safe. Now you could argue that's coincidence. If you want to argue that, that's fine. But I say this is evidence that the Bible's inspired. Because how did Moses know this? I tell you this. The Egyptians ate all of those meats. All of them. And so many of them died. You know, the Jews, it's funny. How many cultures have a continuous history of 3,500 years? There's the Egyptian culture. There's the Indian culture. There's the Chinese culture. And the Jewish culture. It just doesn't fit. Those other, they had these, you know, places with all the farming and all that sort of stuff. I think there's a reason. One of those is when the Jews obeyed the scriptures, they didn't have all the diseases their neighbors had. So you could persecute them all you want, and they'd come back. Not the only reason. All right. Let me see. I'll go on to the next one. Numbers 19, another prescription, if you will. Whoever touches a dead body is unclean. Unclean for 7 days. On the first day and on the last day, he must purify himself with the water on the third and the seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent and the first things, and the people were there. All right. So, why are you unclean when you touch a dead body? In fact, if you think about it, this is kind of harsh, because what that means is those who prepare the body for the funeral cannot even attend the funeral. Why is that? Well, you know, the interesting thing is, in all of these laws, God didn't necessarily tell them why. But all I know is, if you obey the law, you don't die. Now, there are probably things in the Bible you say, I don't know if I agree with God on that. I say, obey it, and then you won't die. You don't have to know why. That's my point. All right, so here we go. Ignaz Semmelweis, a physician in Vienna, worked in a women's hospital. The death rate was 18%. In other words, almost 1 out of 5 women who entered the hospital died in the hospital. That's pretty bad. In earlier times, the reason women didn't have their children in the hospital wasn't because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital, to have the doctor at their home. All right. Now, Semmelweis worked in a women's hospital. They had the disease they called puerperal fever. By the way, I was giving this lesson in Budapest in Hungary, and I'd always been taught that Semmelweis was a Serbian. So I said, Semmelweis, he's from Serbia. After this, they pulled me aside. No, he's from Hungary. I said, I'm pretty sure he's from Serbia. They said, no, he's from Hungary. And they took me to his house. And that's his picture. That's just a little. All right. That was another joke that you guys laughed at that one. Okay, good. So, 1 out of 6 died. The doctors had no explanation. They said constipation or just fear. These women, they're just hysterical. typical male attitude, you know, blaming it on women's hysteria. Come on. Anyway. All right. So what he proposed was this. Here's what the doctors do. They come in the morning, they'd go to the morgue, they'd examine the women who died, you know, and then they'd go up onto the wards and then do the examinations of the live women. We go, they did? How crazy is that? So he said, whenever you touch a dead body, you're unclean. Wash your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water. All right. The death rate went from 18% to 4%. But then Semmelweis said this. Not only should you wash your hands every time you touch a dead body, even when you touch a live patient, wash your hands very thoroughly with soap and water. See, this is in the 1850s when what we call germ theory was just being discovered. Louis Pasteur. The death rate went down to 0.5%. They should have had a brass band parade in Budapest. Instead, a few months later, they fired him. And the death rate went right back up to where it was. Okay? Now, he said, not only when you touch a dead patient, but even a live patient. The Bible also says when a woman has her period, she's unclean. And also when she gives birth, she's unclean. Why would God say that? Well, everyone knows it's because God hates women. Thank you for laughing at that one. That's not true. It's because he loves them. When are women particularly susceptible to disease? And this saved many women's lives. But let's look at the formula. It was water, ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, and hyssop. Why hyssop? Well, again, in these cases, the Bible doesn't say why, but I'm proposing why. Okay? Because hyssop is a very, very oily herb. And if you mix the hyssop with the oil and the acid water, you make soap. But not just any oily herb would do, because 4% of the oil of hyssop is, oh, that's right, you don't see the picture. It's, this compound here, whatever it is, thank you very much, it's thymol. Now, of course, alright, now, it turns out that there's a chemical name for this, it's called a phenol. And when I teach about phenols in organic chemistry, the first property I mention to my students is phenols are antiseptics. What that means is they do not kill human beings, but they kill bacteria. Do you get it? God's formula, when you touch a dead body, was to wash the entire body and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. Right. How did Moses know that? Did he know about thymol? You know, when you go into the hospital, you know that sort of that smell of that antiseptic? It's thymol. Or another cresol, which is another related compound, which would do the same thing. All right, here's the next one. Has to do with infectious skin diseases. All right, my voice is leaving out. Let me see. Oh, yeah, I got lucky. Okay, good. So, it says, you know, for certain skin diseases, if anyone has this, not all of them, but certain ones, complete, utter isolation, quarantine for leprosy. Now, leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. It did not kill the most people. Malaria killed many more people. Typhus killed many more people. Yellow fever killed many more people. The problem with leprosy was the horrible way it killed people. It took years. It was a horrible, horrible disease. Science had no answer. They proposed the alignment of the stars and, you know, eating hot, all these crazy things. But in the 16th century, there were some monks living in Scandinavia. They were reading the Old Testament, and they said, let's try it. Let's try complete quarantine for lepers. And within two generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe. Wow. There you go. All right. I'll give you two more examples of medical wisdom in the Bible. Here we go. Next to the last one. Leviticus 17:14. The life of every creature is in its blood. That's why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Now, basically, he prohibited them from eating blood. By the way, Jesus declared all foods clean, so it's cool if you want to eat blood sausage, but not for the Jews. Now, you know what the most common medical treatment in Europe in the 18th and 19th century was? It was bloodletting. Right? Bloodletting. Here's all the instruments they used. Because the scientific theory was, if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. Which makes perfect sense. Not that it's true, but it makes sense. So they said if you have an infectious disease, drain the blood out to get rid of the disease. Now the Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science says no. The disease is in the blood. Now, which was right? Obviously, the life is in the blood, quite literally. Because if you have an infectious disease, we have a thing called an immune system. We have T cells and leukocytes and white blood cells, all these things. So if you're draining the blood, you're taking the very thing that would save your life out. Bad idea. Okay, let me see. I think this is our last example. Yes. Now, actually, this does not come from the law of Moses. This comes from Genesis. Genesis 17. Of all the examples I'm giving, this will be the most familiar one. It's circumcision. God said to Abraham, Genesis 17, for the generations to come, every male child among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Now I've got two questions. Number one, why circumcise the male children? And number two, why on the 8th day? Now again, didn't say why, right? In fact, these things had a spiritual meaning. Circumcision did, and the whole leprosy thing had a spiritual application as well. Now, it doesn't say why, but I think I know why. Because almost everyone in the ancient world died from an infectious disease, like bacteria, viruses, fungus. Where do viruses, funguses, and bacteria thrive? Wherever it's warm and wet and dark. So think about, on a guy, what's the darkest, warmest, wettest place? Alright? How many lives were saved? And it was primarily female lives, primarily, that were saved. Now, with modern practices, The requirement of circumcision is not as clear. Men, do you take a shower fairly often? Okay. But back then, so many lives saved. But let's talk about AIDS. Several studies have shown male circumcision prevents the spread of AIDS from men to women by somewhere between 60 and 70%. In fact, in some countries in Africa, they've started adult male circumcision programs. I've got a better idea. How about following what the Bible says about sex? One man, one woman, for life. AIDS, gone. God said, every one of these diseases. But why the 8th day? Why not circumcise the 1st day? Or why not the 12th day? You know, the number 12 or the 7th day. I mean, why the 8th day? There's no real meaning to the 8th day to the Jews. I don't know. Well, actually, I do know. At least I think I know. I don't really know, but I think I know. It has to do with blood clotting. Turns out that vitamin K does not pass from the mother to the child. It doesn't go through the placenta. By the way, it's not the vitamin K that produces the blood clot. It's actually a protein that the vitamin K catalyzes the production of. The actual protein is prothrombin. Now, there is some prothrombin. It does pass from mother to child, but a low level. The child is born, because they have no vitamin K in them, it actually drops. So where do they get the vitamin K? From your multivitamin in the multivitamin store? No. It actually comes from bacteria in your large intestine. So where's that come from? Baby eats from mommy? Bacteria? And then it starts producing vitamin K. That's why when you take antibiotics, it messes up your clotting system. So then the prothrombin level goes down, then it goes up, and it goes up higher than the normal equilibrium level, and then it drops down to the equilibrium level. So I'm going to show you a graph. The graph is prothrombin versus number of days after birth, okay? Even you non-science people, you're going to get this graph. Trust me. There it is. Okay? So, from the day a male child is born until the day they die, what is the safest day to do a circumcision? Somebody who's not a scientist, look at that graph and tell me, what's the safest day to do a circumcision? The eighth day. The ninth day is, by the way, there's always a certain amount of uncertainty in science. So the ninth day, the seventh day, the eighth day, the uncertainty is not sufficient to narrow it down quite to one day. All right. So how did Abraham know it was the eighth day? Now, one possibility is he did a double-blind experiment. All right, for the next 10 years, we're going to circumcise on the first day and see what happens. And then for the next 10 years, we're going to circumcise on the third day. This is another joke. Nobody's laughing yet. This is not what happened. What happened is God said the eighth day. All right? So, now, science informs me which God? The God of the Bible. But here's the deal. Let's say this is all the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. Of that, like, this much is the medical and the scientific evidence. That's just a tiny, tiny fraction. Right. In fact, it's not even the evidence that convinced me. It was other things, like stuff I'm going to talk about tomorrow. But it just so happens, a scientific analysis of the Bible is one of the strong evidences that says, this is clearly inspired by God. All right, great. So that's the presentation. And we'll take some questions. Okay. Oh, I forgot. Yeah, I did record it. Good. All right, so it could be questions directly from this talk or questions more peripheral about science more broadly, age of Earth, dinosaurs, stuff like that. And we could go back to the earlier presentations, but I think it'd be more productive to stick to kind of this general topic. So any questions? There's a lot of questions I definitely did not go over. Oh, by the way, there's my website. All these recordings, all these PowerPoints, all these outlines are there. So you've taken those pictures, that's great, but let's go to my website. Okay, questions? Usually the high school students and college students have lots of questions right now. You got a PhD scientist, you must have some questions about how the whole science thing works with Genesis and the flood. Or maybe you never asked those questions. Let's see. Questions. Okay, we have one over there. Our most questioning person. Lots of questions. That's good. With what?
Clothes,
okay.
Movement or in our ICOC or in Liberia Church,
we're still struggling. So I really want you to please help me explain that part.
What part?
The trousers.
Oh. Okay. Now we're doing questions about science in the Bible. Does what clothes we wear have anything to do with science in the Bible? I don't think so. All right, so you want me to talk about trousers?
Yes.
All right, the Bible does not discuss trousers. In fact, in Bible times, neither the men nor the women wore trousers. Does the New Testament give us any rules on clothing? Yes, it says that women should dress modestly. So which is more modest, a skirt or pants? I don't know. We do not need rules about trousers. Anybody who gave you a rule about trousers, they're not arguing from the Bible. They're arguing from human rules. And in Colossians 3, it says, such human-made rules do not help people to become righteous. So if you have your own personal convictions, that's great. All right, but the church does not need to have rules about clothing other than women should dress modestly. But even modesty is defined by culture. What would be modest in one culture would not be modest in another culture. You could have a culture where all the women wear pants and all the men wear skirts. And then, oh, it'd be a sin for women to wear dresses. Come on, let's not have that stuff. Let's just throw that all away. That is from worldliness. That's your Pentecostal church. They have, you know, things about the hair and the makeup. Let's just get rid of all that stuff. We don't need any of those rules. Women, dress modestly. And men, you should probably dress modestly as well. It's just that women don't struggle with lust as bad as we do. Women, we men, we struggle with lust. So help us out. Help us out. Honestly, here it's practically no problem compared to America. Oh my goodness. Oh. Anyway. So I'm sort of making light of your question because it has nothing to do with science, but I hope I gave a reasonable answer to your question. Okay? Now, we don't have to stick to our topic, but it'd be nice if we had something related to, you know, evolution maybe, or the age of the earth, or I don't know, or what about, I don't know, the science stuff. Doesn't have to be, but it'd be good. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for the presentation, sir. My question comes from the point of circumcision.
Circumcision, yes.
Yes. You talk about circumcision, if I got it clear, that it comes from the point that God was trying to prevent the Israelites from getting diseases. Am I correct?
It is a speculation on my part.
Okay.
It's a very reasonable speculation, but it is a speculation.
Okay.
So I try to be careful. Like I say, why did God do that? I say, well, here's what I think. Okay? I try to be careful in doing that. And like I said, the medical advantages of male circumcision in ancient times was very significant. Today, where we have antibiotic soaps, you know, where we take showers, things like that, it's much more debatable. But even if it wasn't debatable, it's not a Christian issue. Right? Just read Galatians. He says, circumcision has how much value spiritually? None. For Christians, circumcision is of no value spiritually. Now, Paul did ask Timothy to be circumcised as a convenience for his evangelism. But they insisted Titus get circumcised. It is no way. It is not a religious issue. Is it a health issue? If it were, it would have nothing to do with Christianity at all. And I would say, let's let the medical scientists answer that question. And in ancient times, absolutely a huge advantage. Today, it's maybe. Okay? We had our son circumcised. All right? By the way, nowadays you don't have to do circumcision on the eighth day, because when the baby is born, they give him a vitamin K shot. That's one of the very first things they do. They give him a vitamin K shot. So if you are going to have your male son circumcised, the first day is just fine. Don't get into a debate with your doctor. All right. All right. So whether it's a health benefit today, I think probably there is a small positive result of circumcision. But whether, you know, either way, that is not a Christian issue in any way whatsoever. That's a personal decision of the family, and the church should not get involved in that. Just, church, just please don't have an opinion, okay? Next. Now, that was a science question. Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for the class tonight. What I want to do, I want to play devil advocate.
Okay, good.
I'm listening up for a theory. You only mentioned the name, but you did not mention the theory, that, like the Darwin theory.
Darwin, what about Darwin?
Darwin Turing.
Yeah.
Charles Darwin Turing.
Yeah.
I want to know, would that be possible, would that be possible biblically, looking at the Turing?
All right.
This egg, whatever, yeah. the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, because God spoke, say, let them be. Maybe it took time and things evolved.
Yeah.
And then when it reached man, and then.
Yeah.
Creation, yeah. Stop when lion reaches lion, the
yeah, sure.
Okay, I want to use the illustration of the channel light.
Yeah.
Okay, this channel light, that came, it did not appear here like this. This light, it came in pieces. And then people put the light together.
Put what together?
This light. This one.
Yeah.
I want to give an illustration of
okay.
this
okay.
light. For example, I was here when we brought in this light.
Okay.
So it came in a box and it came in pieces. And then we took our own time, we put it together,
right.
we put the other side, and then when it became like this, then we hang it.
Yeah.
So in England of Charles Darwin Turing, would it be possible that when God spoke, you know, everything began to evolve, and then when man reached fully man, and then God said, okay, this is what? I'm looking for...
Right. Sure. Yeah, let me answer that question. Now, first of all, I believe that Darwin discovered what God invented, which is evolution. By the way, evolution is only a theory, but it is a very good theory for a number of reasons. A good theory is one which is consistent with evidence and has broadly good predictive power, and evolution has all of those things. But I believe that evolution was part of God's plan of how species could adapt to changes in the environment. And it involves DNA and mutations and populations, things like that. Yes? And I believe God had created Adam and Eve. But even humans are evolving all the time. For example, one mutation that happened somewhere is the mutation that creates sickle cell disease. Okay? But it turns out that if a human being has one copy of that gene, it reduces death from malaria. It's a recessive gene. So, if you get two copies of that gene, which is fairly rare, that's really bad. You get sickle cell. So why did God make sickle cell? Well, God made evolution, which involves mutations and changes over time. But for people living near the equator, especially in Africa, that mutation has allowed them to survive. Malaria is less fatal to y'all than it is to my people, my white people, okay? That's just one example. And so a lot of people say evolution is Satan's plan to destroy the faith of Christians. Who said that? Now, the Bible says that God created the universe. He created life. In fact, he created all forms of life. It doesn't say how he did it. It just says that he did it. All right? And I don't believe that it was just random. In fact, scientific evidence from things like the Cambrian explosion and details, way too much for you guys. There's plenty of reason to believe that fully random processes would never have produced what we see here. Okay, but evolution is a process that nature uses. We all know that the COVID-19 virus has been evolving, which is good for the virus and bad for us. Evolution is real. The theory is not an anti-Christian, pro-Satan theory. All right? And I say, if God invented evolution, let's give him credit for it instead of, like, I don't know, pretending it's not even true. Now, of course, all this assumes that the earth is old, not young. Now, that's a big assumption. All right, that's a big assumption, and that's kind of underlying my argument. So that goes back to the question of, what about Genesis 1? All right, the first day, second day, third day, fourth day, sixth day, etc. Okay. Now, there are two reasonable, hermeneutical, exegetical approaches to Genesis 1. Really, more than two. Let's just say it's two. One approach says those 6 days are literal. And then one day, God creates the universe. 6 days later, he's done. Okay, now, I have you know that even the ancient Jews were of multiple opinions here. Some people said the days were literal. Other people were saying, well, that's more of a metaphorical picture that God used to say, first he did this, that God is a God of order, and he's creating things over time, he has a plan, and all that kind of stuff. And really, the story of Genesis is the story of God creating order out of disorder. And part of how he has done that, apparently, is through evolution. Now, I am of the opinion, and I happily fellowship with people who disagree with me, that those days are not literal. Now, maybe that's because I'm biased as a scientist. But I don't know. Now, I look at a star. I look at a galaxy through a telescope. The galaxy is 1 billion light years away. Got it? Great. The light that's hitting my telescope, when did it leave that galaxy? I'll give you it. It's 1 billion light years away. So how long ago did the light leave that galaxy? That's not hard to figure out. Again, 1 billion light years, which is the distance it takes 1 billion years for light to travel. So how long ago did the light leave that galaxy? 1 billion years ago. So how old is that galaxy? I don't know, but it's at least 1 billion years old, which means the universe is at least 1 billion years old. Otherwise, if the universe was only, say 8,000 years old, we'd have, bing, up, there goes that star. Look, up, there comes another star. Look, there comes another star. All right, so, again, that doesn't prove anything. I'm going to defend the theory of the young Earth. I don't agree with it, but you know what? We should be able to defend ideas that we don't agree with. In fact, I do this, and I teach a science class, Intro to Scientific Thought, and I have a number of young earthers in my classes, a very conservative area of San Diego. So I say, I'm going to discuss the young earth idea, which I know a number of you believe in it. Now, I'm standing here as a scientist. And according to all the scientific evidence, the universe is around 13.5 billion years. All right, students, does that mean the universe is that old? My students say, it doesn't mean that. It just means that's what the theory says. Okay, great. So I'm going to walk over there, and I'm going to pretend I'm not a scientist, but a theologian. Okay? Walk over here. I literally walk across. And I say, all right, let's talk theology. Let's propose, as for the sake of argument, that there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, omni-this, omni-that God. Now, could that God create the universe and the earth to appear old at the moment he created it.
Yeah.
The atheist has to go, yes, he could. Obviously he could. I mean, John the Baptist said God could make children of Abraham out of the stone. I believe that. All right, I'm fine. Okay, great. I agree with that. In other words, maybe God created the earth with an appearance of age. Whether he did or he didn't, that's another question. But I'm over here, I'm saying, okay, well, that's interesting. Because if that's true, that means there never were any dinosaurs. Because the evidence says the dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago. Okay, sure. God created the earth, and he put those fossils in the ground for what reason? To confuse us? Or I don't know. So, amen. You want to hold on to the young earth theory? That's fine, because I really don't care. Just a minute, okay. I mean, whether the earth is old or young, does that matter in any way to Christianity? Not at all. So, fine. I don't get into arguments over this. I really don't. But you can kind of tell what I think. All right? Now, I can tell my answer raised more questions than it answered. All right, I'm going to... I'll take yours here. And then we'll go over there. No. Oh, she's already... sure. Well, okay. You're next, though. All right, whatever. I don't care. I don't care. Oh, you already did a question.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much for science does not restrict who to marry, where to marry, if you want to get married.
Yeah.
But it teaches us to do a test to know whether the person you want to get married to, you are compatible.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Is it based on that concept that God restricted Israelites not to marry outside for a woman?
No. In fact, you could argue genetics tells us, because there are a number of mutations that have happened over time, that's why producing children from a very, very close relative is relatively dangerous, right? And the farther the relationship is away, the better. All right, so arguably, it'd probably be better for a Jewish person to marry somebody who's not Jewish for genetic reasons. All right? So, God told them to not marry the Gentiles for religious reasons. Okay? Yeah, it's not for genetic or health reasons. All right, now the other one, the other question always comes up, well then who did Cain marry? Who did Seth marry? All right? Did they marry their sister? Oh, how gross and disgusting. Ooh, creepy. Now, the New Testament never says that you can't marry your sister. Right? So could a Christian marry their sister? No, they can't, because it's against the law. As far as I know, every country in the world is against the law. Well, why is it against the law? Because it's bad for your health. So what about Cain? Now, what I'm about to say is totally my opinion. And just feel free to ignore everything I'm about to say. Just my opinion. But I believe there's a reason that Adam and Eve lived longer than we do, which is they had a genetic makeup that did not include some mutations that we've all inherited, which meant is why they lived longer. I believe they had a more perfect DNA, if you will. And therefore, there was no health reason that, say, Cain couldn't marry his sister. Now, how many sisters did he have? I don't know, Adam and Eve. They lived, I don't know, a few hundred years. They didn't have birth control. I assume they, you know, got together on a regular basis. So how many children did Eve have? I don't know. 40. I don't know. And by the time Eve is, say, 700 years old, you know, whatever, you know, like, say, Cain is, like, 500 years old or something like that. How many, you know, so... Under those, aren't you glad that we don't live that long and have that many children? Because the population of the earth would just go crazy. By the way, there's exactly one command that God gave to human beings, we've done an awesome job with. Fill and multiply and fill the earth. Yeah. That one we've done really great on. All right. So, I believe God said not to marry your cousins and your sisters and brothers for health purposes. Not that it's inherently wrong or even sinful per se. Okay? But the law of the land says no, and science says no, so I say don't do it. But you would not be breaking a New Testament command to do so. Oh, except yes you would, because the Bible says obey the governing authorities. The Bible also says, essentially, use your head. Don't do stupid things like marry somebody through whom you're going to produce lots of diseases. That's not a quote, but anyway. All right, next question. All right. How about if you choose, not me, because I'm doing a bad job of choosing. Okay. Well, we're here for questions. We're here for questions. All right, if you have a comment, give a very brief comment, please. Go ahead. I can't hear you. Alright, is this a Christian question? Because I'm looking for questions that relate to Christianity. Okay. Okay. No, I want to hear what he's asking, but I just want him to get to the point that relates to Christianity. Okay. 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 Very good.
Okay, in short, the form of God test, but now is DNA.
Yeah, so what's his point?
DNA. What's... The Bible will let us know that as knowledge increases,
so make it a point, the science gradually is giving credit to the Bible.
Yeah. Yes. I agree with that. I agree with you that. Yeah. And I agree with what you're saying. I apologize. I might have been a little bit too impatient. If I was, please accept my apology. All right. But I agree with what you're saying more broadly, which is the more we know from science, the more we see the quality of inspiration of the Bible. I agree with that. I also agree that science gives us many positive accomplishments, which are helpful for us. It also creates problems because science allowed us to make nuclear bombs. That's not so good. Science allows us to do some other things that I'm not so happy about. But generally, science, and by the way, science is a direct product of Christianity. That's a historical fact. The very first scientists were Christians who believed in one unchanging God who created the universe, so they believed the universe should be governed by one set of unchanging laws, which is consistent with Christian theology, and there you go. So science itself was created by Christianity. Thank you very much. All right. It's not really very late, so we could take a couple more questions.
Yes.
Not a lot more, but a couple more. All right, she's been waiting for a while. Okay. But you're next, okay? It doesn't matter. Whichever, it doesn't matter. All right. Go for it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much. You talk about, you explain about various elements that shows evidence of God's creation of the world. And my thought is, if God created the world, it means that he is in control of the world. So my question has to do with, if God is in control of the world, is he responsible for everything that happens in the world?
Okay, that is a great question. By the way, God is not fully in control of the world. Right? Is God's will always done? Definitely not. What Jesus gave the model prayer in Matthew 6, right? He said, pray to God, your will be done. Why would you pray for God's will to be done if it's always done? Because it's not always done. When somebody rapes a woman, that was not God's will. There's a difference between what God allows and what he causes. Not the same thing. Now, I say that God's in control, but we have to understand what we mean by that. We mean, in the big picture, despite the fact that many things happen that God does not agree with, in the biggest picture, God is in control. It's Romans 8:28, God works all things out for the good of him who love him. So in that sense, he's in control, but honestly, in another sense, he is not. Why? Because he gave us free will. All right? Dogs don't have free will. Stars don't have free will. Planets don't have free will. The grass doesn't have free will. Rocks don't have free will. Everything God created obeys him. Except us. Why? Because he loves us. He doesn't love the stars. He doesn't love the grass. He loves us. And love gives a choice. Can you make somebody love you? No. It goes back to the most fundamental question, which is this. Why are we here? Because God was bored? No. The reason we're here is God wanted to love us, and he wanted us to love him, to love one another. And to glorify him, by the way. In fact, Are you a parent? Who asked this question? What? Oh yeah. Are you a parent? You are. No, alright. Alright, are you a parent? Alright. Now, getting pregnant, well, the actual initial getting pregnant, we won't talk about that, but, I mean, being pregnant, that's, yeah, it's painful, and then it gets worse, you know, you gotta change the diapers. Why would anybody, I mean, seriously, why would anybody have children? Because you want to love them, and you want to be loved by them, and you want them to be blessed. I mean, that's the reason. But love gives a choice. You know, there were two trees in the garden. The tree of life, awesome. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, I don't know. I don't know. Why did he put that there? Did he put that there in order to tempt us? No, God does not tempt us. But he could put it there in order to give us a choice. Really, Adam and Eve, we have a lot of choices. Really, Adam and Eve just had two choices. Accept God's will or not. You know, and it had to be attractive. The choice was not between $1,000 or I punch you in the nose. That would not even be a choice. It was between having what I've given you or having even more knowledge. Ultimately, sin is saying to God, what you want us to have, I don't think that's enough. I want more. All right, but why did God put that tree in the garden? Because he had to. Because we needed to choose him. All right? And that explains why these things happen. It's a strange thing, but the reason there's evil in the world is because God loves us. That sounds crazy. But if you think about it, that is a true statement. It's what the Bible says. The reason there is evil in the world is because God loves us. Okay? Love gives a choice. So, we say God's in control. That's true in one sense, but it's not true in another sense. Okay? That explains why bad things happen. All right, you've got the microphone.
Yes, sir. Thank you again. But that's when you talk about uncleanness.
About what? Uncleanness, yes.
So a kid of my mom, your brother or sister, and I told her, she told me that you're coming to church. So after that time, when I met her, I said, oh, you told me that you're going to come. What happened? She said, I was unclean. I said, what do you mean about unclean? And Jesus told us that what makes us unclean is what comes from out of our mouth.
Okay.
So I tried to help her, but she said, no, but excuse me, sir, menstruation comes from out of me, so it makes me unclean. So really, I need her help to be able to really help her to see. Yeah, because I'm studying.
All right. So what she's saying is, I would come to church, except I'm unclean, right? And you can say, okay. But that's why I go to church. The reason I go to church is because I'm unclean. That's like saying, the reason I won't go to the doctor is because I'm sick. That's what she's saying is about as logical as saying, the reason I won't go to the doctor is because I'm sick. The reason I won't go to church is because I desperately need to go to church. You say, all right, I respect your opinion, but honestly, to me, I don't get it, because that's kind of like saying the reason I won't go to the doctor is because I'm sick. Because what's the solution to the uncleanness? It's God. God is the one who gives us a clear conscience. You could read maybe, I don't know, Hebrews 9. You know, the Jews, their laws created outward cleanness, but didn't create inward cleanness. It created what Hebrews 9 calls ceremonial cleanness. But what we need is not ceremonial cleanness. What we need is real cleanness, which is forgiveness. So I'd say, you know, I understand the emotion you're feeling. You know, maybe you're feeling you're unworthy, or I don't know exactly. Maybe you could ask a few questions. Maybe probe a little bit to find out what she really means. Because I can't tell, and you can tell me what she means, but it doesn't matter. Ask the questions. Make sure you understand what she's really feeling. And that should help design your answer. But if she's feeling what I think she might be feeling, which is she's unworthy or something like that, or maybe she's just making an excuse. And they say, all right, well, make all your excuses you want. I don't know. Depends. But if she really feels just deep down she's unclean, I go to Hebrews 9 and I say, right, God is the solution to what you're feeling. So not coming to church is a little bit like saying, the reason I'm not going to go to the doctor is because I'm sick. Now, again, if you want to tell me what you think she's feeling, that's okay. So I would gear my response to depending what, because I want to know what she's really actually feeling. Like I said, possibly she's just making up some random excuse just to make you go away. And the Bible says, do not answer a fool according to their folly. You know what I'm saying? So if she's just making some dumb excuse to make you go away, I wouldn't confront that. I'd just say, all right, well, obviously she doesn't want to come. And the reason she's giving is nonsense. But, you know, sometimes when people say utter nonsense, best thing to do is say, all right, thank you very much. Have a great day. I don't know. But my guess is to let her realize the thing she wants to be solved is going to be solved by God. Okay? All right, I'm pretty tired. I started teaching 10 hours ago. 10 hours of teaching, that's a lot. So I beg to be, like Moses said, let my people go. Let me go for now. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless you. I'm very grateful. God bless you.